think all of you should know this. At least I hope you do. But just since I post this on the internet, I think we ought to look at this really quickly. And that is the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 15. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Messiah? Shall I then take away the members of Messiah and make them members of a prostitute? May it never be. Or do you not know that the one who joins himself to a prostitute is one body with her? For he says, the two shall become one flesh. But the one who joins himself to the Lord is one spirit with him. Flee immorality. Every other sin that a man commits is outside the body, but the immoral man sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and that you are not your own? I think it should be obvious to everyone here that prostitution is wrong. I would hope everybody here would say, well, yeah, duh. But I wanted to say that as a way of introduction, because this doesn't give any ifs, ands, buts. There's no excuses here. There's no wiggle room. There's no clause for exceptions. It's just simply wrong. And that applies to not only those who are prostitutes, but those who pay prostitutes to do what prostitutes do. Right? So both sides are wrong. You say, why in the world is he talking about Genesis chapter 38? Back with me to Genesis chapter 38. I could think of no other place to kind of put that in, but that is our disclaimer there. And you'll see why in a minute. And if you know anything about Genesis chapter 38, you won't need any further explanation, but I wanted to put that ahead. I've titled this thing Sin and More Sin. This is another one of those chapters where you look at it and say, well, who did the right thing? And you stop and you think for a minute. You think for another minute and you say, well, I don't know. I don't know if anybody really did the right thing here. Genesis chapter 38, starting verse 1. And it came about at that time, remember Joseph had just been sold into slavery. At the time he was sold into slavery, all the brothers were together. At that time, that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. I don't know if it was because of what they did to Joseph that he was disgusted with them and he decided he had to move on, or he decided it was time, he moved on. Some people have speculated back and forth about how old Judah was. We're not sure. It probably occurred after the time that Joseph was sold into slavery. And since Joseph was the youngest and he was 17, that would have put Judah probably in, you know, early 20s or so. Verse 2, Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her. So she conceived and bore a son, and he named him Er. Then she conceived again and bore a son and named him Onan. She bore still another son and named him Shelah. And it was at Chezib that she bore him. Now Judah took a wife for Er, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Er, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. Now we've got to stop for a minute and kind of pause on that one, because the brothers had just sold one of their brothers into slavery. They had just deceived their father by saying the child was dead. Even before that, in the time of Shechem, we had two of the brothers who had wiped out almost single-handedly a whole town full of people, most of them innocent. And whatever Er did, or whatever he was, it was worse than that. Because God didn't take the life of the brothers. He didn't take the life of brothers who participated in Shechem. Didn't take the life of them that participated in the selling of Joseph into slavery. But this guy took the cake. We don't know what was going on, but he was bad to the bone. And so God had to take him out. Verse 8, then Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring from your brother. That's something called levirate marriage. It's where the brother takes on, the unmarried brother takes the wife of the dead brother, that he may raise up children in his brother's name, the dead brother's name. So verse 9, Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so when he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, so he took his life also. That was probably just the last straw. I don't think that was enough to have caused God to have taken him out, but it was certainly the last straw. Whatever this young man was like, God had had enough. And so, that's it. You're done. He took him out. Verse 11, then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. For he thought, I'm afraid that he too may die like his brothers. So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. In other words, Judah is thinking, well, same woman, brother, son number one, dead. Son number two, dead. What's the common element here? The woman. So if I give the woman to brother number three, I'll have brother number three, dead. So he basically told her, go away, let's do lunch. I'll get back to you. I'll get back to you. Don't worry, don't call us, we'll call you. So he sends her away. Verse 12. Now after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. When the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, near his friend Hirah the Adullamite. Okay, so at this point, we have Judah's wife dies. So he's now a widower. He has not given his son to Tamar yet. And so what is Tamar to do about this? Verse 13, it was told to Tamar, behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. Now, sheep shearing in those days, we sort of see it even in the book of Ruth further on, that sheep shearing is not just a one-day sort of thing. It was this festival. It was when they all got together. It was a great big party. Woohoo! And so this seems to have been the sort of thing, you know, traveling, business trip. All sorts of things happen on trips like this. And we see what's about to happen. Verse 14, so she removed her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in the gateway of Enayim, which is on the road to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah had grown up and she had not been given him to his wife. Now, we've got to think about this for a minute. Verse 15, when Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. Now, she came up with this plan to seduce her father-in-law. And she dressed up as a prostitute and went by the side of the road so he would see her. We've got to stop for a minute and we think, well, why don't you think that was going to work? There was something going on here in Judah's life that this was apparently his dealings with stopping to visit prostitutes on the way to shearing may not have been a one-time deal. It may have been that this man at this point had fallen to the place where this was a common event in his life, or else how in the world, it certainly wouldn't work on me. I hope it wouldn't work on any one of you that if someone would dress up as a prostitute, that it would immediately a bone to a dog or whatever, just eyes wide and just rushing into her arms. In this case with Judah, it was like, oh yeah, okay. Yeah, okay, I was looking for a prostitute. There you go. Like, all right. Verse 16, so he turned aside to her by the road and said, here now, let me come into you, for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, what will you give me that you may come into me? He said, therefore, I will send you a young goat from the flock. She said, moreover, will you give a pledge until you send it? He said, what pledge shall I give you? And she said, your seal and your cord and your staff that is in your hand. So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. As somebody said that I was reading, that she got by far the better deal in this case, because that the cord, the staff, the signet ring, those were what really were the marks of his leadership in the family or in the tribe. And it's sort of telling that at this point he has really given up the symbols of his leadership, because at this point morally he was totally bankrupt. And so at this point he indeed no longer deserved to have those things, even though he wasn't thinking that. I think that's what was in God's mind, that he had totally fallen to such a state that he no longer ought to have those symbols of his leadership in the family. Verse 19, then she arose and departed and removed her veil and put on her widow's garments. That's how I read that little thing in 1 Corinthians. Both of them were wrong. Both of them were wrong to doing this. It was just such a mess. You know, when we try to think of a way out of a situation in our own strength, our own flesh, it usually turns into a mess. Although I hope to God none of you are currently in a mess that is this deep or this complicated or such a mess, such an awful mess as Judah and Tamar are. But this is not untypical of people who come up with schemes. You know, you watch movies and TV shows where people come up with all these elaborate schemes. And on TV and the movies, they usually tend to work. I can tell you from, you know, being a schemer before I was a believer, that schemes, they don't work. Not most of the time. I mean, there's something called survivor's bias, and that the people who brag about the schemes are generally the people who succeed. Those who don't succeed generally keep quiet about them. So the only ones you hear about are the ones that work. You don't hear about the ones that don't work. Verse 20, when Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. He asked the men of her place, saying, where is the temple prostitute who is by the road at Enaim? But they said, there's been no temple prostitute here. I mean, that's something out of a sitcom. Here, go give this to the hooker. And they go to the street and they say, okay, well, we're looking for the hooker to give her a pay. And they say, oh, what hooker? There are hookers on our street. It's like, okay, what do we do now? You know, this guy leading this kid from the flock, this goat around, trying to find this prostitute to pay her. Verse 22, so he returned to Judah and said, I did not find her. And furthermore, the men of the place said, there's been no temple prostitute there. And Judah said, let her keep them, otherwise we will become a laughingstock. After all, I sent this young goat, but you did not find her. In other words, I tried to pay her, but I did my part, and so you couldn't find her. So Judah just goes his way, like, okay, you know, sharing time, this is what we did. Probably didn't think any more about it. Verse 24, now it was about 3 months later that Judah was informed, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot. Behold, she is also with child by harlotry. And Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. Excuse me, Judah. It's like, you wouldn't have prostitutes unless you had people who were paying the prostitutes to do what prostitutes do. So all of a sudden we have this rash of righteousness, hypocrisy rather, over someone who had just visited a prostitute. But no, not in his own family. In his own family, she ought to be burned. The stranger by the street, woohoo! Much different. Never mind that she had a family of her own and a father of her own. And that's something that we see even in our day, that people kind of have this twisted view, even of women. I mean, there's a great deal of exploitation of women in our culture. And I've heard this before, and that's something that men who are ever tempted by any sort of pornography or immorality ought to stop and remember, is that the people that you are dealing with, they have their own stories and they have their own families, and they are people who are loved by God, and that they're never to be treated as just objects or treated as something that you pay for sexual favors with a lamb from the flock and then move on and forget her absolutely and completely. That was kind of the point of that 1 Corinthians passage is that this was not something that was just an amusement, but rather it was something that was deeply spiritual. It was a union of not just a union of two people that ought to be treated as something that's more sacred than this. But as far as Judah was concerned, nope, all of a sudden there we have this flaming righteousness. Verse 25, it was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law saying, I am with child by the man to whom these things belong. And she said, please examine and see. Whose singing and ringing chords and staff are these? Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah, and I did not have relations with her again. In other words, this was not a continuous, incestuous kind of relationship, but rather this was this one-time thing. Neither one of them was right, but at least they didn't make it worse by continuing on the relationship. Verse 27, it came about at that time that she was giving birth, that behold, there were twins in her womb. Moreover, it took place while she was giving birth. One put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. But it came about as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother came out. Then she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. So he was named Perez. Afterward, his brother came out who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. So you might say, well, here we were in the middle of the story of Joseph. And kaplunk, here comes this story, right in the middle. You've got to ask yourself, why is this here? I think one of the main reasons why this is here is this is showing us what's happening to the family. That we've kind of picked out the different brothers out of the 12, and we've seen that really none of them were behaving in a godly way. They were all becoming Canaanites, in a sense. They were all taking on Canaanite morality. They were all taking on Canaanite way of thinking. And so, therefore, it was important to get them out of Canaan, get them to Egypt, to get them into a place that, if it wasn't righteous, at least was a step above what they were facing in the land of Canaan, because this was really not going well. It was interesting, the book of Corinthians was written to a people that weren't far removed from the morality of the Canaanites, but yet, with believers of the Spirit of God, that we have the power in us to resist this sort of thing. This chapter is also in there for an interesting reason, too, that it is something that speaks about the grace of God. And you say, well, what grace of God? We had two people who died, that God took them. Look with me forward to the book of Matthew, chapter 1. Matthew chapter 1. Verse 1. The record of the genealogy of Yeshua the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Perez was the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram. Ram was the father of Aminadab, Aminadab the father of Nahshon, and Nahshon the father of Solomon. Solomon was the father of Boaz by Rahab. I wanted to include Rahab because she was in a Haftor reading. And so here we have the Messiah of God, holy God, righteous God, and in the line of the Messiah, even in the line of King David himself, you have two prostitutes. Well, I'd say you have at least two prostitutes. That she is mentioned, Tamar is mentioned explicitly. There are only three women that are mentioned explicitly in this genealogy, I believe. I know that the wife of Uriah is mentioned, and these two. God is making a point here, and the point here is a point of His grace and His love, that in the line of the Messiah that He admitted these people that were decidedly not perfect. I mean, Judah was not a perfect man. He redeems himself later on in the story of Jacob, of Joseph, in a sense, because it is apparent that God is working on him. You can kind of see a little bit of that because he admits his guilt in the matter when Tamar shows him his signet ring and his staff. A lesser man would have killed her anyway in order to cover it up, but he admits right away that it was his fault, or partially his fault, that all this was going on. So we see a little bit of change of heart on Judah's part. And later on, when we go into further the story of Joseph, we can see that Judah is traveling with his brothers. So I think his forays among the Canaanites were short-lived. I think he rejoined the family eventually. But you can see God's working on these people, that really the selling of Joseph into slavery, all these other things that are going on, really a low point for the family in terms of their morality. It speaks again the importance of really guarding yourself against the influences all around you, because these people were falling into all the Canaanitish way of doing things. You know, the Canaanite religion allowed for temple prostitutes. We see that word being used in this section, that their religion was so corrupt that their worship of one of their gods Ashtarte, I think it was Ashtarte, and then she was associated with Ishtar and came into the Greek and Roman pantheon as Aphrodite, you know, the goddess of love, so to speak. And I think in the Greek pantheon is Aphrodite, into the Roman pantheon is Venus. And it was just this idea of prostitution as part of the religious ritual that kind of speaks to what the Canaanite mindset was like, that it was really awfully corrupt. And lest you think that we are free of that, when you start getting into and understanding what some of the religions that are rising up in America nowadays are like, particularly Wicca and some of these other religions, that they are reviving some of these old ways, these old pagan ways of thinking. And then you have a lot of people in America who really don't think much about religious stuff at all. They are all about amusement and sensuality and what is fun right now, as opposed to what is good in the future. So we ourselves have got to resist all that. We've got to kind of get our mindset on what God is thinking and not what the people around us are thinking, and not trying to make our own solutions to problems. Because both Judah and Tamar were acting in ways that were not in accordance with God's plan. They all had their own schemes. I mean, Judah's scheme was, well, let's keep her away from my son, instead of praying to God and saying, God, reveal to me what's going on here. Why have my two sons died? I'm sure God would have told him. I'm sure God would have told him. But instead, he jumped to conclusions and decided it was Tamar's fault somehow, and not really his own fault for not raising his children properly, so that his children would wind up being so evil. It's just such a mess. It's one of those chapters where I say, you look back and say, well, who did the right thing? About the only time anybody did the right thing was towards the end, when Judah admitted that he was the father, that he really acknowledged the children as being his, and acknowledged the fact that he'd done wrong. Up to that point in the chapter, you can't point out anything that says that somebody did something right. It's all just one misstep after another. And that's what sin is like. One misstep leads to another, until finally all sorts of strange, corrupt, complicated things are going on. And how in the world do you get out of this? It's funny that his comment about giving his staff and things, trying to find the prostitute, giving back at it, said that we would be a laughing stock. Well, he was worse than a laughing stock, I think, for a while, when he admitted that he had relations with his daughter-in-law, thinking she was a prostitute. I think that story kind of got out, that he was trying to hide all this by having his friend do all the transacting for him. I think it came out. So all this stuff was, he couldn't hide it, and we can't hide our sin either. Keep ourselves pure. Go for God's standards. Do not trust the thinking of the day. I don't remember what kind of statistics I've... There was something about 44% of married couples, at least one of them, has had a one-night stand with somebody. I don't know who did the survey, how reliable it was, but it was just awful, the statistics that are coming out in terms of morality of our day. That we just have to draw our line in the sand. We have to put our banner down and say, no, that is not me, that is not us. We are not that people. We are a separate people. We are a people holy unto God, and we do not do those things. We do not do those things. I don't care how much people around us seem to be enjoying themselves. I don't care how much the people around us are telling us we're stupid for not doing it. We are not those people, and we will not do those things, because those are the pagans around us, and we are not of their kind. We are the Lord's people, and we'll do things the Lord's way. Let's pray. Dearest God and Father, I thank you for your standards and your word. I thank you also that you have shared with us the accounts of the ancestors of your people, whether they did well or whether they did badly, so that we could see and learn from their mistakes. Work in our lives so that our lives might be one of leaving a good testimony, that the story of our lives wouldn't be one that people point to and say they were lives which we didn't do anything right, but rather they would be testimony of lives well lived, that your name might be glorified and many around us might see the difference that is in us, the hope that is in us, that we might be ambassadors of your holiness to those around us, that they might see and understand and be able to make good divisions between the holy and the unholy, between right and wrong, that we might be faithful in not only teaching your word, but also in living your word, that the name of our Messiah, Yeshua, might be glorified. Amen.